greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I'm your host, Ted Flanagan, and today we're talking with Sean Neiman. He's the founder and CEO of Cal Solar Inc. They've done over 600 large-scale projects in California, a lot of multifamily buildings, a lot of public sector buildings. Sean has grown this company and is breaking through the barriers to solar in California, proving that rooftop solar is alive and well in the state of California. Thus, happy to have Sean on the program today. Hey, Sean, welcome to the podcast. It's good to see you again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Ted.
Delighted to have you. And where are you sitting now? Are you in your office in LA or are you somewhere else? You can never tell anymore, right?
Yeah, I'm in a home office in LA. I am much more productive out of my actual office in Little Tokyo, downtown LA. But today had to be with my daughter for a nursery graduation. So decided to take the rest of the day from home. But generally speaking, I'm always in the office.
Yeah. And well, congratulations on the graduation. That sounds exciting.
Thank you.
What's hot? I mean, I know you got back-to-back meetings. You're running a big company. But this week, is there a big focus in particular this week?
There's always a big focus, I would say. I think we try to take, bite-sized bites out of any issue we're tackling on a given day, week, or year. So what's hot? We've had a little bit of turnover in our contracts team. So we have executives that are stepping up to fill that void. We have new people in our business development team. So we're ramping them and getting them abreast of kind of the accounts that they should be targeting. And maybe they've inherited some project opportunities from previous business development managers that we need to bring them up to date, and then trying to balance it all with family and marital duties and all that. So I think it's, that's got to be part of the discussion as well.
You've got a very full plate, I know, going on. And you started Cal Solar in, I believe, 2008. So you've been at it for 16 years. You've built this company up.
That's about right. So just for semantics, we go by Cal Solar Inc. There's several Cal Solars out there. So we're the Cal Solar Inc. or California Solar Integrators. We actually started in 2014. I had my first foray into entrepreneurship between 2008 and 2014 with a company that I started called ReGreen. But since 2014 with founding Cal Solar Inc.
And how many people are you up to now?
We're just slightly over 250 full-time staff here at Cal Solar Inc.
Oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic. And when you started Cal Solar Inc., what was your mission? What was your vision? What was your focus?
I knew that I wanted to be in commercial or non-residential solar. I enjoyed the business-to-business relationship building aspect of renewables. At my previous company, I had also done some other energy efficiency and water conservation measures. I knew that I didn't want to take that holistic approach. I wanted to really refine my craft in one of those, call it measures. So either efficiency, water conservation, or renewables. And so I like renewables. And then the first kind of like aha moment, or I don't know if you would even call it a moment, but it was because it's such a small market back then. I noticed that there was certain projects that had to do solar as a new construction mandate, and the mandate could come from a funding source or a building department or a planning department. And so I said, hey, I'm going to hang my hat where people have to use my service and not optional.
Right.
I think optional works really well for residential because residential PPAs are very quick and easy. And, you sign a contract and, probably 15 minutes if you want it on a single family home. but I experienced the CNI payback sale. And it was always, call 1,000 people to get maybe half a project. I don't even want to say a whole project. So I knew that at least this way it was a much smaller market, but I had a really engaged audience from the gate.
Very interesting. And this whole notion of helping clients achieve their compliance, I've been poking around a little bit. You're doing that with new construction, and you've done a lot of work in with multifamily, and you've done a lot of work in the public sector. Where are these required solar installations at this point?
Yeah, so I think when we initially started, it was there was like low-income housing tax credit funding sources that would give you more points on your competitive tax credit pursuit if you opted for solar. So that was one area. The next area was, certain cities in California had REACH codes. Yep. And so I identified those as opportunities. Later, the building codes now have changed to pretty much require solar and or battery storage on most new construction projects. And then one area of opportunity that I see is that a lot of solar companies out there are either just sales organizations or solar finance organizations that don't either draft a single plan set or turn a single wrench when it comes to the execution of the work. And so we execute a lot of work for other solar companies that actually are not performing the engineering, procurement, or construction of the work themselves.
Yeah, but and you wanted to have all of these functions under one roof, so to speak.
Yeah, I initially, when I got into the industry, I was actually like, I'm going to do this whole thing using subcontractors. Mm-hmm. And that was my whole thing, is having low overhead, not taking job cost risk, and passing that down to a subcontractor. And after a while, especially in new construction, because there's so much coordination involved between design consultants and the solar design and other trades and the solar trade, I quickly determined it wasn't something that would be good to subcontract, because you would get a lot of finger pointing, and at the end of the day, I wanted our clients to know that if they need something, they just need to pick up the phone and call one number, and that yep. that call didn't have to turn around and call another number.
Right. You've sort of bucked the trend, haven't you? I mean, a lot of firms are subcontracting. That's their model. Minimize risk. Keep that overhead low.
Sure, we bucked the trend. It's pretty risky endeavor, in my opinion, in the ever-changing landscape of everything solar, which includes supply risk, cost escalation risk, policy risk, and so on and so forth. But we also have now a subject matter expertise and, a significant scale that, it's really hard. For example, someone could come to my company and say, I've sold, 20 retail, 20 locations for, Fortune 100 retailer. I'd like you, Cal Solar, to execute the portfolio and achieve permission to operate by, within 12 months or something.
Yeah. And nobody else can do it.
Yeah. Right. And so that's something that no one else can, not no one else, but not a lot of people. We have this scale that covers basically every inch of California in-house. So it's hard to find someone with that scale.
And I'm sure that's deliberate, Sean, that you're keeping operations in California, but are you tempted now to expand out of California or?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's opportunities in other markets. We've been successful because we've scaled, vertically, we've scaled our vertical integration. And so I do see opportunities in other markets. but I want to take my time because I don't want to basically adopt a subcontractor model in other states. So we definitely have, we hold licenses in several other states right now and kind of setting the next 3-year plan on entering some more states.
And right now, as I understand it, you're headquartered in Los Angeles, but you've got offices in San Diego and then up in the Bay Area, I think it's up in Hayward.
Correct.
Is that right? So you're able to.
We office in LA and then we warehouse an office in San Diego and warehouse an office in Hayward as well.
Right. And at this point, over 600 large scale projects?
Probably more than that. Closer to 1,000 over the last, 10, 12 years. A lot of good learning lessons along the way. and a lot of, it's interesting to kind of like drive by any locale really throughout California and be able to point to a building like we did that project.
Right. Now, I imagine that a lot of them were solar only projects. And I want to talk about storage and EV charging in a second here. But one project that really caught my attention that's on your website was this, the world's tallest solar water heating project. And that just sounds like a colorful story. Right in downtown San Francisco, I take it. 42 floor building, and you put solar on the roof, and you were piping all the way down to the basement. Is that how that was configured?
Yeah, the boilers and storage tanks were actually on the roof along with our equipment. So we actually managed all the piping between our system and the boiler and the storage tanks. And then the plumber handled all the piping down from those tanks and boilers into the units. So our work was confined to the rooftop. But yes, it was a very interesting, pitched metal trellis they had built for us to attach to. The GC was Swinerton. The developer was UDR. They were opting to do solar water heating because under the old code, building code, it had significant improvement to Title 24 performance. So it was really the most cost-effective way to achieve Title 24 conformance. Mm-hmm. And that's, so we opted to do that.
For our non-California listeners, Title 24 is our California building code, and which has lots of energy efficiency requirements and now solar requirements. Sean, normally all that plumbing would have been down in the basement, right?
Correct.
So I mean,
a lot of projects either opt to put their plumbing equipment like boilers at grade, but a lot also put them on the roof. So if they're on the roof, then that's less piping we have to do between our system and the boiler.
Yeah, absolutely. Now that particular building, what was it, 399 Fremont, 477 apartments?
Correct.
So a big building. And what percentage of your water, domestic hot water is produced by solar in that case?
I believe that project was a few years ago, back in probably 2017, but I believe it was about 20% of the expected usage. And again, the reason people do a lot of solar hot water is for that Title 24 boost, less so like the offset or the savings. And I almost hate to say that, but it's the fact.
It's a reality. Yeah, that's a reality.
And so now
how hard is it to maintain a system like that when it's up that high in the air?
It's easy to maintain all types of renewable energy systems as long as people are willing to pay for the maintenance. I think, that's also a disconnect in the industry, is a lot of people spend a lot of money up front and then kind of neglect the ongoing maintenance.
Right. Do you offer ongoing maintenance services for both the solar electric and the solar thermal?
Yep. We do that in-house. So again, not third party. And, you know, we try our best to do it for only the projects we've constructed. But from time to time, a new client or an existing client has, you know, a troubled project, and we step in and help them out.
Mm-hmm. Now with multifamily, let's talk multifamily, but let's talk solar electric. And when you do multifamily projects, you're putting up a large array on, or a large number of arrays on a multifamily housing complex. And how does that billing work? Is that virtual net energy metering, or is it something different?
That's a great question. So generally speaking, if you have an infill project, say a podium project or a wrap project, those types of projects generally are going to have a significant common area load because they're infill. And so they're generally 5+ stories. They've got a lot of elevators, a lot of conditioned corridors, so on and so forth. So the owners of those projects have two options. They can either offset their common area consumption and do a net energy metering or a NEM paired system and offset their own common area consumption. Or if they are within a utility that does allow for virtual net metering. So for those of people outside of California, virtual net metering is a mechanism, a billing mechanism offered by certain utilities that allow you to reduce the number of interconnections. So you can benefit apartment dwelling unit tenants without actually physically tying in a small system per meter. So you design and build a system somewhere between 1 and say 5 interconnection points. And then you tell the utility, hey, here's an allocation form. Please virtually allocate bill credits to each of these tenants at this rate. And so a lot of owners right now, is that's the way they're going, is rather than offsetting their common areas, the residential rates are significantly more expensive. So they'd rather allocate those bill credits to the tenants and then turn around and say, hey, sorry, tenant, like, you know, not sorry, but hey, you've got to buy this energy from us. And as long as they don't charge the tenants more than what the utility would have charged the tenant, then they could charge the tenant the going rate of electricity in that local, you know, utility.
And so I know we've tried to do a number of these VNEM projects in Santa Monica, where we've been a consultant for years, and there's a lot of complexity. You're making a good case for the economic values of it, as opposed to picking off your common area load. Seems like the complexity with tenants, so they come and go, right? They have different views on this. Have you been successful with VNEM projects?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, they're complex in the sense that every utility has a different way of designing and interconnecting virtual net metered systems. So really understanding the requirement utility by utility is critical. And it could lead to potential change orders and cost overruns if the solar company that's executing the work is not experienced in, you know, this type of work. Furthermore, yes, we are seeing the first, you know, few thousand units being brought online where tenant billing is being adopted. And so I would say the adoption and the execution is new. So obviously it's going to have some inherent issues. You're going to have a lot more success on a new construction building, basically forcing a tenant to buy the energy from the solar system or the landlord, because, hey, if you want to lease this new unit, you got to sign this. And then for existing buildings, you have to go out and actually convince a tenant to opt right to buy solar energy from you. And sometimes they don't want to, or you can't get a hold of them, and yeah, so on and so forth. But what owners do is they assume at some point in the next, you know, call it 1 to 3 to 5 years, this tenant is going to move, and they're going to basically make the new tenant have to sign up for the service.
Interesting. All right, now let's shift to a topic I'm really fascinated by. Panel level energy storage. This is cool. I never heard of this, Sean. And we've all heard about, you know, big battery systems, Tesla Megapacks and Tesla Powerwalls for households. But here you are, or here is, I guess, a company, Yada Energy, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, that's developed a small battery that lays underneath every single panel. How are you doing with that technology?
So also, much like the tenant billing craze, call it if you want, if you can call it a craze, it's a new technology. We're excited to deploy these systems on our projects where it makes sense. We've actually just completed our first project at UC Hastings with a Yada battery storage system. What's nice is it's very modular. So most battery, commercial scale batteries come in multiples of, at the minimum, call it 125 kilowatt hours. So if your project only needs 80, you're stuck buying the one at 125. What's nice about these Yada batteries that are 1 kilowatt hours each is you can just buy 80 of them. Furthermore, it gives you a lot more ease of design and construction of not having to locate a space for an indoor battery or an exterior battery that, again, has its own setback requirements for the buildings, bollarding requirements for the buildings, you know, ventilation and fire suppression requirements within the buildings. And so it's kind of a easy button, if you will, for smaller scale battery storage.
Three quick questions on that. Weight. Is weight an issue? I mean, when we go up on rooftops, weight is an issue, whether we're doing unballasted or we're doing ballasted systems, something we have to look at. Are these batteries adding significant weight? I mean, they look like they're about an inch and a half thick by, I don't know, 12 by 18 or something like that.
They're about 50 pounds, but the weight is being distributed across, you know, some sort of racking system. Generally speaking, I haven't found it to be an issue, but it is case by case, and your older buildings have to really, you know, take that into consideration.
Sure. But
generally, I haven't found the weight to be an issue, and they're working on a second generation version that's supposed to be significantly less weight.
Even lighter. Okay. Yeah. And then I take it they're UL approved.
UL approved, CC approved, and
how certification. How about cost compared to you know, compared to a Powerwall or a Megapack or, you know, any of the other batteries that are out there? Do they bear a significant cost premium or not?
They do bear, I would say, a significant cost premium, but they also bear advantages of less coordination. And once you factor other costs associated with incorporating a building, a battery into an existing building, such as the fire suppression, the ventilation, the civil utilities you need to get to and from the battery, then it's, I wouldn't say equal, but not as significant.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the, you mentioned it already, some of the regulatory changes, and you must be the master of rolling with the punches. Because here in California, I understand you've worked with about 13 utilities. They all have most of them have different regulations. But in California, what we've heard from CALSA, the Solar and Storage Association, and others, pretty much the sky is falling for rooftop solar. And maybe that's most pronounced in the residential solar market, where the net energy metering, the export rates are dramatically lower. But what's your reaction to that when I say that the sky is falling for California solar?
You know, I think the solar coaster is an interesting one. And I think the policy change is across the board. The policy change is federal between, you know, tariffs on modules having a significant impact. Imagine you have a project under contract and all of a sudden your modules now cost, you know, 15 to 40% more. How do you go and agree, get the owner to agree to a change order. So that's a policy shift. Or you're operating in California where the utilities are adopting new net energy metering rates that reduce the value of exported energy, or they're implementing prevailing wage requirements, which significantly drive up the cost of these projects and therefore drive down the payback. So how are we dealing with it? The best we can. It's definitely hard to scale a company with so much change and basically having to go and, you know, rebuild the widget halfway through every time and say like, all right, now change your module, spec designers, because this module won't be tariff, or now client, you know, get your applications rushed in, because if you don't, next year, all your projects will be prevailing wage. And oh, now that it is prevailing wage, please sign your project up for a DI, a Department of Industrial Relations project number. So we can, and they're like, what is that? Cause there, a lot of those are private works. They're not used to that. So, dealing with it the best we can and trying to really, reduce the hit for our clients and internally for our staff, because it's just, change is hard to put out there across so many people.
Yeah. Sounds like you spend a lot of time communicating with your clients.
Yeah, we touch our clients a lot. And that's one of the reasons we have to have such a robust team, is there's a lot of touch, especially in new construction. You literally have to like rebid the job 10 times. You have to design it and update your designs maybe another 10 times because the building design keeps changing. And so it's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Right. What are some of the other exciting projects that you've worked on? I mentioned that San Francisco high rise, but when you think back on your career doing this, there must be some projects that you're most proud of.
Yeah, I kind of put our work into a few buckets. So if we take the multifamily bucket, we're doing several megawatt plus systems for some of the largest multifamily owners and developers. And so really before, you wouldn't see a megawatt on a multifamily project. So I'm excited about the direction multifamily is going and the scale. On the commercial front, we just rolled out a 6 megawatt portfolio for a company named Reyes Holdings. They're one of the Coca-Cola bottling manufacturers in the US. And so we rolled out 6 sites, about 6 megawatts. That's been a fun relationship to work on and a set of projects to work on. And then we have, you know, the run of the gamut of our public works jobs on either a transit authority or a California Highway Patrol building, something of that nature. So across the board, I kind of view it all as fun and all as a way to build new relationships.
You told me earlier that your daughter just graduated today. So we hear a little bit of fun in the background, but I wanted to ask you about balance. And obviously you got a lot of family stuff going on there. But how do you maintain? You seem to have a cool, calm demeanor. You're very successful. You've got a lot of stress, a lot of business, like you said, a lot of flux, constant change. How do you keep it all together, Sean?
I mean, I think something's got to give. You can't have a true balance, in my opinion, or at least I haven't had one yet. I'm not at home as much as I like with my children. I'd love to be taking them to school and having dinner with them each evening. And that hasn't happened quite yet. I have a 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and 5-month-old, but, that's kind of like, the price you pay, I guess, growing something.
Yeah. And now you've expanded into You've been doing solar electric, solar thermal. We talked about battery storage systems. I think you're also into EV charging now.
Right. We offer EV charging and canopy construction. And EV is an interesting one. For now, we've deployed a lot of level two chargers. I haven't seen a lot of us rolling out level three quite yet.
And are you getting, are you looking, are you kind of tuned into the whole decarbonization of the industry? Are you looking at potentially moving towards other decarb strategies, heat pumps and things like that? Or is that out of your lane?
No, that really actually falls into what we're doing. We did a few fuel switching projects last year where we took some gas water heaters and converted them to electric and added more solar to account for the additional load from those electric water heaters, centralized water heaters. There's a lot of opportunity out there in decarbonization. And as we evolve, I think one of the ways, best ways to grow is to expand the service offering.
What else do you want to tell me that I haven't hit on? Is there anything else that is top of your mind about your business and your success to date that you want to bring up?
It's all about the people. I know everyone says that. I can't stress that enough. It's a great industry. I would encourage everyone who's considering either a career change or new to their careers to do their research and join industry, join organizations and request meetings with, you know, managers and executives of companies that they're interested in to learn more and see how they fit. I think we have a significant glut in field expertise. And so we're empowering our next leaders in the field by putting them through apprenticeship programs and getting them to a journeyman level over the next few years. And so these days as a journeyman electrician, you can earn upwards of $70 per hour on a public works job. So, you know, you put in some sweat equity, go through a 5-year apprenticeship program and, you know, making $70 an hour, that's probably equal to about $140,000, $150,000 a year in income. That's significant. So I'm a big believer in trying to, you know, help grow people's careers, help employ as many people as possible when possible. You know, sometimes it's harder because of economy or and stuff. And so really encouraging people to jump in, you know, and learn more. And
when you do hire, what are you looking for? I mean, I remember the Southwest CEO always said he hired based on attitude, but what are you, Sean Neiman, looking for?
Yeah. So early in my career, I just looking to fill a seat and that came back to bite me. And now we really look for people that meet our core values. And really for me, that's the most important thing is find people that meet our core values and then it could probably be a long-term fit.
And what are those core values, if you had to just put a thumbnail on that?
Growth-minded, relationship builder, grit, integrity, tenacious, and process-driven. I think I caught them all. We called it GRIPT, G-R-I-P-T. Yeah. And I guess it's actually a word. Yeah. So I think finding people who meet our core values is really, for us, the best way to find a good fit.
Yeah. Hey, listen, congratulations on your success to date. You're an inspiration to me and I know to others. And I like the fact that you're telling younger folks that might be listening, this is the industry to join. You know, don't listen to this chatter in California about rooftop solar going so far south, because there's still tremendous opportunities. We still have a tremendous need to tap this free renewable resource. So thanks so much for what you're doing. And thanks for being on the podcast, Sean.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. And thank you for you know, what you've done for the industry, and I'm amazed to see over 100 podcasts. That's significant. And I didn't know that you had a newsletter since 1984. I want to actually ask you, what were the modes of distribution of such newsletter in 1984? Was it all like print, or I don't know. I wasn't born yet. So
yeah, it was print. It was print, believe it or not. I mean, we were researching and printing and mailing snail mail newsletters all over the country, different parts of the world. I thank many of them are still out there. I thank my early subscribers. At this point, we're completely free. We do electronic distribution every month, and it's fantastic. So, yeah, we've come a long way, baby. But I like you, find all of the nuances in the industry. You know, all of the regulatory shifts, all the technology advances. It's just so exciting. So, again, thanks for being on the podcast, Sean, and it was fun spending some time with you.
Thank you.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.